Welcome to episode 208 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today is a special interview with snowboarder Xavier Delarue. Xavier is a multiple snowboard cross world champion and freeride world tour winner. We spoke about his competitive past, the cliff named after him in Verbier, his move into filmmaking and adventures in places such as Alaska, Svalbard and Antarctica. We also discussed his almost fatal avalanche and how it changed his views about risk-taking. Finally, we talked about sustainability and his Audi Experience camps taking place in Verbier this winter. It was a real pleasure to speak with Xavier. I found our conversation fascinating, and I'm sure you will too. I'm delighted to be here today with Xavier Delarue. Hi, how are you?
I'm very good, except for three broken ribs.
Right, you mentioned that. How did that happen?
That happened, I was on a trip in the Lofoten, like riding some lines, so you put a little bit of exposure, and then in the afternoon I just found this one wave in the middle of nowhere where I did not expect it. I thought, okay, I have my boards in the back, I'm going to go and surf it. Took my board under my arms, my wetsuit in my hands, started walking on the parking lot, slipped, landed on my surfboard, and completely broken. Yeah, three of my ribs.
Ah, painful and very hard to do anything about ribs, you know. You just have to kind of leave them be, don't you?
Apparently, yes. Yeah, it's my first time, so yeah.
Your first time, that's pretty amazing when you consider your career, because in case the listeners are not familiar, you are a four-time border cross world champion and three-time freeride world tour champion on snowboard as well. And we're here in Verbier today where we're talking, which a lot of people consider to be the home of freeride. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that you have a cliff named after you on the Bec des Rosses, is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yep. The Delarue Cliff, right?
Yeah.
I take it that's because you hucked off that at some point in one of your lines.
Yeah, it was 2010, the finals of the World Tour. I think my third title. Like, pretty big cliff, but with a pretty exposed landing. So you have to be really precise into your directions. And that's placed quite high in the face. So, like, that was quite major hit at the time.
Freeride World Tour has increased its position in most people's awareness in recent years because it really has come forward a lot. I think FIS have got involved in it as well. Did they buy it out?
Yeah, they bought it out.
Yeah, exactly. If listeners have never watched any of the Freeride World Tour before, I'd highly recommend it because you're talking about extremely steep and difficult skiing and snowboarding with a lot of extremely high quality technical action within there. Although I guess you were there in the vanguard of it in the noughties, as we call it, because you won that competition 3 years in a row, 08, 09, 10. Had the Freeride World Tour been going long at that point?
That competition, like the Verbier Extreme, had been there for maybe, like, now it must have been like 20 editions. So it's been there since like the 90s. So yes, in 2010, it had been quite a while. There had been quite a lot of freeride competitions, but they only gathered together onto the Freeride World Tour from 2007. So that's when it became more of a like legit tour kind of in a way, whereas before that was independent events only.
And the Bec des Rosses, very famous face, which you can see if you go up the jumbo lift, isn't it? If you're looking over on the right-hand side as you're going up, yeah. If anyone is in Verbier and they want to try and imagine what it would be like, they just need to have a look at that. We just saw a fantastic photo outside, which was a photo taken at night. That was celebrating 25 years of that event, is that right?
Yes, correct. And there was like 25 candles in a way, like, so which means 25 people sitting on the ridge at night, like to celebrate all 25 candles kind of in a way. And on top there was three riders, so Yann Rosies, Jeremy Heights and myself. So we had like big LED strips strapped around the helmet, like a big headlight, and we had to go in and drop into that face, which is already scary enough in the broad daylight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I remember the feeling of it being quite impressive.
Was it a moonlit night? Did you have much light on it at all?
No, there was no light at all. And it felt like going into the abyss, like literally. Once you were in there, that was fine because the light would, you know, lit up all the snow around you. So yeah. That was okay. But before that, at the start, because everything drops so much around you, there was no reference points at all. So that was really bizarre.
And were you hiking up in darkness as well?
Yeah, the hiking was fine. You know, like hiking, you know, we're used to hiking in darkness. Whenever you do like some steep skiing, you go into a refuge, you know, like very often you could start, you know, climbing at 4 o'clock or something like this into the night. So that's something quite common in mountaineering.
But a unique experience. And that photo is tremendous for sure. I'll put a link to that into the show notes. I mentioned your early career, you know, was competing border cross and free ride world tour. But more latterly, you've moved into films and just generally exploring and having adventures all over the world. We're going to talk about the Audi Experience Camp that you've got coming up this weekend here in Verbier. But I wondered if I could ask you, like recently, I think you're out in Antarctica.
Yes, very much. So I was in Antarctica in November, December.
And what was that trip about? Were you filming specifically when you were there?
So yeah, it was a North Face project. It was a long thought out project. It's been about 5 years that we tried to make it happen. And this time, so like the idea was to go with my brother and my daughter. So my daughter turned 18 like when we were down there. And like to kind of share a bit like this incredible adventure, tell a bit our stories as a family, and also kind of see like the idea of exploration and like being on such a big trip like this through the eyes of my daughter and also through the eyes of my brother and myself, like all of us being kind of almost three generations. Because even if Victor and I were brothers, we're 10 years apart, so like I'm a grandpa compared to him. and then my daughter is like almost the same difference below him as well. So it's an interesting perspective.
So what kind of weather are you getting in Antarctica at that time of year?
So at that time of the year, it's like turning towards the end of the spring, towards the summer down there. So that's when the weather turns. So you start to have more sun. And this time we had like quite a lot of clouds, but maybe a third of the days were sunny, so which was good. But we witnessed like really different conditions from the previous time that I went, which was like 12 years ago. And we talk about this thing of global warming. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was like so freaking vivid down there. We went at the same time as we would normally go. Which is normally quite borderline with the sea ice, because normally you're not going to get blocked in some of the bays and stuff. And there, since September, there was pretty much no more sea ice. And you could feel, compared to the previous time, like 10 years ago, that the season had shifted drastically. Like it felt a lot warmer, a lot more like springy and summer.
Okay, well, we'll touch on sustainability a little bit later on. I'm interested in the logistics of that trip, because you're based on a boat. Is that how that worked?
Yeah. And it's a very convenient way to travel. So basically you take a plane to Ushuaia, and then from there we went on a small, tiny sailboat. It was like a 60-foot sailboat. And just sail across the Drake Passage for 5 days. So Drake Passage being the most challenging traverse on the planet, so you can imagine. And then once you're down there, you're in between fjords and you travel around, you live on the boat, and you just go through the fjords and try to kind of pick a zone that you like, get closer, pick a line that you like, go hike it.
So essentially, you know, you're on the boat, you're looking at these mountains coming up out of the sea ice, and deciding where you're going to take a line and, you know, which descent you're going to take. And, you know, I saw some of your photos on Instagram. I mean, some of those descents look pretty steep, right? It rises very quickly out of the sea.
Yeah, and also down there, you know, like the situation, having those runs so much above the water, like so connected to the ocean, they're like the snow is filled with a lot of moisture, so it sticks to the walls like nowhere else. It's very different to the Alps. Any cliff will transform itself into a rideable patch, so you end up riding like slopes around 65, 70 degrees. It's ridiculous. It's like a completely other experience. But at the same time, that snow is amazing for riding steeps. You know, it's a snow that's quite dense, that carries quite well when you hike it. And also when you ride it, not everything just like sloughs down, you know, like below you. You don't really touch the bottom, touch the rocks, you know, it carries quite well. Yet at the same time, you still have a good grip with your edges and stuff.
So that film, it's a project with the North Face. When will that come out?
The film will come out festivals around October. So it's going to be in festival till December, and then probably beginning of December, it's going to be available, most likely on YouTube.
And what's the title?
For now, it's The Drop. Well, it's always been The Drop, but the director leaves himself the chance to change the title.
Yeah. Did you say that Mila had her 18th birthday while you were in Antarctica?
Yes, on the day before we hit the sea on the way back. So we had scored all our descents and everything, and kind of like a celebration of the trip, as well as being her celebration for becoming an adult woman. Yeah. Which was crazy.
Right, wild place to have a party.
Yeah.
So I wonder if I could take you to one of your other adventures, because there's so many. There's no way we'd be able to cover them all. But that's, you know, right at the bottom of the Southern Hemisphere. You've been up to Svalbard as well. When you were in Antarctica, you're skiing and there's penguins around. But when you're in Svalbard, there's polar bears around. And I think I'm right in saying that, you know, you have to have someone who has like a rifle to with them the whole time when you're up there.
Yeah, polar bears are another very interesting element to play with. Especially so when you sleep in tents, like the way we did, you have to put like a wire on sticks around your whole camp, and on all the sticks you have fireworks. So if the bear comes closer, the fireworks are going to explode. That's going to scare him, and at the same time, it's going to wake you up so that you can grab your rifle and and potentially have to shoot it. Yeah, it's quite intimidating, and luckily we didn't see one, but yeah.
Okay.
It's something to be taken seriously.
But you're a long way, let's say, off the beaten track, because you're skiing faces there that if something had gone wrong, there's no kind of emergency services just around the corner that would be able to help you?
No, yeah, you could potentially, if it's a good day, get a heli that would come from the capital, from Longyearbyen. Probably take maybe an hour or an hour and a half of heli, if the heli is available, if the conditions are right. There are some, like, options for rescue, but it's not just a given.
And what about the terrain, the skiing there in comparison with Antarctica, for example? How did you find that?
Well, the terrain there was like, it was not coastal, so it was like a bit more inland. It was like on a glacier. So there's the ice cap in Svalbard, so it's like really a very thick layer of ice. You know, it's not just the glacier, is like, I don't know, a few thousand meters of ice, so it's quite big. I don't know how big it would be in Svalbard, but for example, in Antarctica, that would be like 4 kilometers on the continent, but on the fjords, it's more like normal glaciers. Very, very cold. I remember it was about minus 30 all the time, which was like quite painful.
You mentioned the cold, because I think I'm right saying that Ed Lee was with you on this trip, is
yes.
That right? So I've met Ed and interviewed Ed a bunch of times before on the podcast, and I know that he found the cold very, very difficult on that trip.
We had camera cables breaking from the cold.
Is it right that ski boots could actually, you know, crack? They could get so cold, because you had to, I saw a photo of candles inside a ski boot just to keep that warmth in there so that they would be okay.
No, it's not to crack, but it's just that, like, you could not get in them. I don't have that problem, but yeah, like Sam and Tamatan was doing like this. Yeah, he was like, yeah, putting a little candle, and that would be enough to soften a tiny bit the plastic so that he would be able to get into them.
So many different places that you've been to. I guess I should bring up Alaska as well. You mentioned your brother Victor before. He was with you in Antarctica. He said he's 10 years younger than you, but he's clearly following in your path, because he is currently leading the Free Ride World Tour. I think there's a competition coming up in 2 days' time. He's won the first three, right? So he's on course to win that title as well. But you went to Alaska to kind of introduce him to Alaska?
Yeah, it's true. Like, I don't even remember which year it was, but yeah, we did our first trip together. And I came across recently some images from that, and it was funny to see him with his younger face and know what he does now. Because actually he's got a project that he started last year with Mark Crusader, and they're going again this year, and they're pushing the boundaries of what we've seen, and it's going to be freaking mind-blowing. And when I see what he does, yeah, compared to that one trip, it's like there's been some improvements. I'm super proud of him.
Will you be following what's going on in Fieberbrunnen then on Thursday?
Of course, yeah. We've got like this WhatsApp group with the whole family, and we all like super fired up.
Because I was reading on the Free Ride World Tour website of all of the different scenarios. He's really
I'm not going to say he's almost certain to win, but, you know, because he's won the first three races already or competitions already, you know, he's in such a strong position, isn't he?
Yes, I'm not sure exactly how it works with their ways of calculating, but he can become world champion on the next stops. He's in a good place in his head. He's having fun. He's showing amazing snowboarding, and he's like actually elevating the whole side of it on the Freewater. So
yeah, well, the force is obviously strong in your family, because you mentioned that Mila had her 18th birthday in Antarctica, but she's competing in the Free Ride World Tour as well right now.
Yes, she is, and she just made it from the juniors to the adult a few months ago, and she just got qualified for the challenges. So if she does well on the next four comps, we could have two Delarus next year on the Free World Tour, so Victor and her. So.
Yeah, that would be pretty amazing. And just, you know, so listeners understand, I mean, there's a limited number of places, aren't there, to be able to compete on the Free Ride World Tour, the A-grade competition.
Yeah, it's super exclusive. It's like maybe 10 girls or something, so worldwide, you know, so it doesn't leave much space. It's hard to be in there. And once you're there, you also have to keep your spot, which is quite difficult. So
so she stepped up from the junior world tour. She's in that challenger circuit, you said, at the moment. So depending on her results there will depend whether for next winter she'd be able to compete on the senior free ride world tour.
Yeah,
well, best of luck to her. Like I said, the force is clearly very strong in your family. I think that you and Victor both from the Pyrenees originally.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, Saint-Lary?
Yeah, Saint-Lary.
Yeah, I've been there. One of the few British people who's been to Saint-Lary and skied there. And my personal impression was I really enjoyed the ski area, quite a big ski area. But what I really liked about that area for me was it was so different from the Alps in terms of the cultural influence. Because you've got like a road coming in from Spain into Saint-Lary, haven't you? Mm-hmm. So you're more likely to hear Spanish than you are to hear English, for sure.
Yeah, it's like maybe a tunnel. And in 20 minutes you're in Spain, and it's like two very different geographical kind of influences. And on one side the Pyrenees is very green, and on the other side it's like desertic almost. So it's like very nice when you're there. It's bad weather on one side, you move to the other side, it's like sunny, eat tapas and go biking. And I think that creates kind of a pretty chilled kind of environment, and people are very welcoming and quite warm. So,
but that's where you develop your skills. When did you decide to come over to Verbier? Yeah.
Well, I moved when I was 18. I moved to Annecy in France as well, like to do my studies. And from there, I was traveling and doing all the comps around the world. So I was not really based anywhere. But then I based myself in Chamonix for 5 years, and then moved to Verbier in 17 years ago.
And one of the reasons for moving to Chamonix was to develop your kind of high mountain, your mountaineering skills as well.
I was super hamped on learning as much as I could from the mountains, and it really served its purpose. But also Chamonix is amazing, but it's also quite intense. So then I got my first daughter, and living out there was like quite full on. So I think Verbier was the perfect scenario, like with the perfect free riding, and at the same time, you know, the sunshine, like the, you know, like no one cares what you're going to be doing, which run you've been riding during the day. There's a lot less competition. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Chamonix in summer and in winter. I really love it there. But having come here again to Verbier now for the second year in a row and been lucky enough to go out with, you know, some really good skiers and guides. And today we just did something completely different. We went over to Brusson and discovered some really great skiing over there and fresh tracks, you know, 2-3 days after the snow has come. And I think, you know, okay, it is a Tuesday in March, so it's a bit quieter. But in Chamonix, everything gets tracked out super quickly.
Yeah, well, it's another Mecca free riding, but yeah. Everything gets tracked up, but it's also that, whatever you want to do, it's like you always have to push yourself, because it's like really high mountain environment with a lot of glaciers and stuff. So you always need to be prepared to be really on top of the conditions. You cannot, but it's hard to just go up and wander around and find out what you do on the day. You always need to have a plan. So it's a bit exhausting after a while.
And it's interesting talking about, you know, learning those new skills. I was looking on your YouTube channel at the how-to series, and there are some excellent videos on there, you know, covering everything on there from how to build an igloo to how to create a splint for a fractured pelvis. So it's like covering a lot of ground on there. And I'd recommend people have a look at them. Some of them might be not so useful. There's one on there which is about how to ski ice. I'm not sure there's so many people who are like keen to kind of ski across the type of ice that you were doing there.
Yeah, it was just something I did for a while. Like in the north faces in the high alpine, you always have this ice, especially in the beginning of the season. So it's like blue ice, which eventually at the end of the season gets covered and with where you can ride on it. But that would be seen always as something which you had to rappel over it. And then at some point I was like, come on, this could become a feature. We could just straight line it and ride it. And as long as you don't put your edge, you can stand on your feet. So yeah, it's quite a mental game because you once you get on it, you know there's no turning back. And the only way to do it is to point.
Well, I watched that video and in it you actually say it can be full on but enjoyable. Like, okay, I'm willing to believe you. I'm not necessarily going to try that for myself. And you know, you also talk about ice axes and climbing the face and working out the best way of doing it. Probably that sort of thing is for like aspiring free riders perhaps.
Yeah, I think I was like, yeah, touching different levels for sure, and some of them were quite full on, but for me it was important to create content which was not just being consumed and thrown away. And I was like trying to share a bit some of my experience and give back instead of just bragging about this amazing life I have.
Well, those are, it's what I would call, as I work in content marketing, evergreen content. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those videos can be watched at any time and they're still relevant and still useful. Is that series over or are there any more to come, do you think, of those?
Well, it's the first year I haven't done anything with it, but yeah, I'd like to, you know, shift a bit towards a bit of a smaller format, which I could also put on to my social media and stuff. But with all my kids, I struggle to do everything.
For sure. Well, I understand about that as well. Just on the videos, I think what's also really interesting and really relevant in there is that you've got videos in there about how to cope with avalanches, how to choose a line, how to, you know, manage those experiences. And I know that, you know, from your own personal experiences and friends who've been involved in avalanches, that's an important area for you.
Yes. Yeah. It's quite something which has been quite a tough topic for me because I got taken into a big avalanche in 2008. And it's like, it's been a very impactful experience in a bad way, of course, because, yeah, I was literally shocked when it happened and, yeah, never wanted to touch a snowboard again. But also at the same time, it's been the best lesson I could have because from that day on, I had seen the worst in a way. So whenever I needed to take a decision in the mountains, it became easy. So yes, since then, you know, it's always made me very, very cautious into the mountains, and it's kind of completely changed my approach I had up there.
Where was that avalanche?
So that avalanche was above Orsières, yeah. Champelac. It's like not far from here, yeah. Actually. You can see it from when you're up on the slopes here in Verbier.
And you were like carried quite a long way by that avalanche,
yeah,
right?
Over 2 kilometers, two, yeah, kilometers and a half almost, yeah.
Did you have any injuries from that?
I had a bit of a sprained knee, but I was like borderline to being dead. Picked me up after 10 minutes and I was like head in the snow, suffocating and being...
So evidently, you know, an experience like that, you know, can be life-changing in many ways. And, you know, I've read that in some respects, you think it's important to cultivate fear when you're thinking about different lines and thinking about potential scenarios. And actually, paranoia can be a really good thing.
Yeah, it actually has been my technique for, you know, working on it. You can imagine after such an event, like your first reaction is like, why should I be free riding? It's just too dangerous. And it's true that back in the days, I would finish all of my season and be like, wow, like I've been lucky quite a few times this season. And it always felt like I was really playing with, you know, with my luck. And then eventually after that accident, I was like, come on, I love it too much. I cannot stop. And that was in itself a revelation for me, you know, to being like, okay, no, I can't let it go because it's too important for me. But at the same time, how can I find a way to make it more viable, to make the risk more acceptable? Of course, there will always be some risk, but like I need to find like kind of a way to make it better. And for me, kind of felt it kind of came by itself that, yeah, cultivating fear by being up there and not necessarily get swallowed into the I'm having the best day of my life with my friends. Everything is so beautiful. The power is so good. I need to hurry up because, yes, some other people are coming. You know, like all of those things which make you just forget, like the risk or not necessarily focus on all the directions where the risk can come from. Because basically in the mountains, every situation, every scenario is different. And you can get tricked in so many ways. So that if you're not really aware and available in your head for risk coming left, right, and center, you can get tricked really easily. So I've always felt that by forcing myself to be scared, you know, I would be really focused on potential dangers.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting what you said there, because I think I've seen this in your videos or I've read it. You're saying to people, like, don't rush. You know, take your time, think about it, don't let that adrenaline take over. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, let's say you're skinning up a route and you want to get there to the top before the others, and you can see them taking their skins off and you want to get those lines down there. But to take your time. I wanted to ask you as well, whether you think, you know, now, very different situation, let's say from, I don't know, 10 years ago, the number of people who have airbags, for example. Do you think airbags add to an illusion of safety amongst skiers?
You know, it's like many things. You can always watch this problem in two different ways. And I think that for sure the airbag situation is exactly the same. So you can see it in that way where you think that, yeah, airbags will bring like a false safety, which is true sometimes, but at the same time, it will protect you so much if anything happens. So what do? You're not going to say it's one or the other. I think it's good to realize that it actually can make you feel too safe sometimes. But I think generally from what I've witnessed in general, it doesn't necessarily does. For sure, a lot of people have all the gear and feel that they're safe because they have all the gear. And they should train more. They should try to realize more what the real risks are, because I think a lot of people don't realize. Unless it happens to you, it's actually hard to realize. But, you know, that's the way it is. Like, we're humans. Like, we tend to see things in a positive way, which is a good quality, I think.
As you say, you know, assessing risk, there's a lot of different factors that go into it. And I think, you know, if there's something that we draw from what you're saying, is it's kind of good to have some fear and good to take your time, you know, to help you make those correct decisions.
Well, yeah, I think I would be right with you, but the fear, I always find that there's, you know, the good and bad fear at the same time. You know, there's a fear which is good, which is healthy for the, you know, for the right reason. And then there's the fear because you're at the wrong place at the wrong time, you know,
yeah.
Like you shouldn't be there. And that one you should take even more seriously.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't say that this is the way to go, but it has always been the way to go for me. It works and I cultivate it and I highly recommend it. But if you have another technique, like...
And so, you know, conditions in the mountains change the whole time. We look at the avalanche, you know, danger numbers, and the situation, you know, will change during the course of a season. But, you know, we have seen, I don't think anyone who lives in the mountains, you know, would deny that climate change is having an effect, and that can have an impact on the safety on the mountain as well. And... Well, a little while ago, you were running a series of podcasts, which I found really interesting. I listened to a couple of episodes there, specifically about sustainability and trying to get that awareness out there. Was that something that you turned to specifically around that time?
Well, two different things there. First of all, I think the climate change affecting the avalanche situation, I think there might be a bit of a false image there. Of course, there's going to be less of a like regular climate. So of course, you know, there might be more temperature variations, which might make the situation a bit more avalanche prone sometimes. But I would think that generally the fact that temperatures are raising, you know, brings safer snow up there, because usually, you know, like the rain level will be higher, so anything that will rain above that rain level will be generally quite safe, I find. But that's my perspective. So yeah, for example, like in the two previous years, we've had two really dangerous years because there wasn't much snow, I think, and that was actually the problem. So that it created really a bad layer from the beginning of the season. So any little layer that came on top was always super slidey. Whereas this year, it's been the snow level has been quite high. So in the low resort, there hasn't been much snow. But here in Verbier, for example, above 2,400 meters, there was always plenty of snow from the very beginning of season, and it's been snowing constantly, and it's been snowing quite warm, so it's been very good and stable snow. So I think it's been an amazing season in a way.
Okay, so I mean that's an interesting view on addressing specifically the impact of climate change on avalanches, but overall in terms of your thoughts on sustainability.
Yeah, in a general problem, like skiing is just a very low piece of the problem, and it's actually a kind of a useless situation as we know it. It's like changing rapidly. We see it in our environment, but also globally on all levels. Like we see that everything is kind of going in a really weird way. And and I'm very concerned. That's for sure. So yes, I had the chance to meet with this science called Johan Rockström. Like there was an event here in Verbier about the climate, and he completely touched me. And then the Antarctica project has been done with the will of sharing a bit some of his theories. Like the trip got cancelled the first time, but we recorded all this podcast, and it was very important for me to being able to share them, because I think they were so impactful, so easy to understand. They changed me, so I wanted to share that.
Well, they are very interesting. I recommend listeners have a listen. They're on your website. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And one of the reasons that we're meeting here today in Verbier, I'm obviously here for the trip, but you have an event coming up. And I guess there's a link to sustainability there as well. It's an Audi Experience camp. Part of that experience, I mean, maybe it'd be good if you explain to us what goes on, but I noticed that everybody gets a chance to test some of their new electric vehicles as well.
Yes, I've been an ambassador for Audi for quite a few years, and since 3 years I've been an electric car ambassador, and I've been very happy to promote that. And it's been very cool to being able to test the system on my side, and like I had the chance, of course, to being given the car.
Yeah.
So which made it really easy. I pled guilty, but it's been completely eye-opening for me. And now since 3 or 4 years, I kind of dropped. I had 3 cars. Now I only have one electric car, and we do everything with my family with it. We're so happy, and I don't ever see myself going back to it.
Well, it's nice to know evidently that it's possible to use them in ski resorts where temperatures go down. The Audi Experience Camp, wondered if you could just give us, because it's unique, this event, right? You want to explain how it works over the kind of 2 days that people sign up for?
Yeah, it's a camp where we go free riding, and I spend time with people, like riding some lines, touring, giving advices on free riding, on everything. And then in the evening, we've got a really cool setup at 2,800 meters of altitude, a bit sideways from the Atlas Couloir. And we've got a really amazing camp up there that is organized by Antoine. So he's a friend of mine actually from the Pyrenees, but who's been living here as well for a long time. He's got a company called Basecamp Events, and he organizes camping, like super nice and unique camping in unique places.
And certainly that's unique. It's what in British we might call glamping. But people are still staying in tents at 2,800 meters, right?
Yes, exactly. So it's sleeping at 2,800 meters. So probably temperatures ranging between -5 to -15, depending on the day. Yeah, it's gonna be cold. It's still gonna be quite full on, but with good equipment, so it's gonna make it.
Yeah, and how many people are going along on that?
So it's gonna be about 15 people, 15 customers, and then there is some people from Audi. So it's gonna be in total probably 20, 25 people.
Yeah, and even if people aren't used to it, still sleeping at 2,800 meters, it's not like high altitude, but it's still high enough to make a difference if you're used to sleeping, down at sea level.
Yeah, even for myself, like every year, if you haven't slept in a tent for a while and stuff, it's quite full on in a way. But it's such a unique experience because it's up there, it's above Verbier in a way, and you've got like the full view towards the sunset, towards the whole Mont Blanc massif and stuff, and the view is just unbelievable. So
yeah, I mean the images are amazing. I will share some of those and drop them into the show notes. Well, I really appreciate your time today, Xavier. There's obviously a lot going on. I wish you all the best with the Audi camp and also the recovery, you know, with your ribs as well. And that Milo all the best for the end of the season. And let's hope that Victor, you know, picks up victory in the Free Ride World Tour. And hopefully that will continue down the generations.
He would get his third title. He would match me.
A bit of sibling rivalry there, right?
Not at all, actually. No, we're quite good in our family. We're just feed on each other's successes.
Excellent. Well, maybe Milo will be the next generation who'll come through and do that. That's brilliant. Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Xavier for all of his time. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I'd like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at The Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. If you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can subscribe, or you can book your ski hire with Intersport Rent using the code SKIPODCAST, or simply take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied at the checkout. You can follow me at the Skipedia and the podcast at the Ski Podcast. Finally, listener, thank you for joining us, and until next time, goodbye.